Hello, everybody. Friday, 5 p.m. here at WHPC 90.3 FM. It's time for American Hit Radio. We're here every Tuesday and Friday at 5 p.m. with my lovely wife, Heidi Morales-Ryan, here to help me out. And we've got Earl Holder helping me out on engineering, doing the right thing. Now, if you listen to us on Friday, you know we like to cover how music changed. And we've covered a few of early episodes. And what you're hearing in the background right now, actually, is the Maple Leaf Rag as recorded by Scott Joplin, one of the original piano rolls. I hope you've been listening to some of our other shows, because in most of our early shows that we've covered to date so far, we've covered an awful lot of generalized topics, fairly big topics. The first show was on the tenors and the birth of the recording industry, people like Enrico Caruso. We then covered the death of European tradition, which is to say how European music began to come to this country through people like Dvorak and eventually found itself established through mostly African-American music. We then had Birth of an American Identity, which had to do with people like, who listen to right now, Scott Joplin and such. We covered American pop music for a while, where we covered people like Sousa and Burt Williams, a little bit of Al Jolson. Then we did a show on the birth of jazz, where we got a chance to look at people like Ubi Blake, James Europe, the original Dixieland Jazz Band, and even a touch of Freddie Keppard. And finally, we wrapped it up with a three-part series on the birth of the blues, which brought us up to W.C. Handy. Today's show, I'm recapping all this because with today's show, we're going to bring them all together. It's a bit of a special show because this is going to be the show that brings all of those different disparate elements together in one person. This is the first of our early series of shows where we're going to focus on...
Does that also mean one style of music?
Well, it means... Actually, it depends on how you look at it because...
Married?
We're talking about pretty much how jazz basically became what it is and how all of these things from the blues and earlier elements of jazz like ragtime and even pop music all began to come together. The whole vaudeville tradition and how it was expressed in one person, that one person being Jelly Roll Morton. It's going to be very special. Now, the other thing that makes this show very special is that Jelly Roll did an awful lot of the work for me. I am not going to have to do an awful lot of the talking on this show because shortly before his death, Jelly Roll sat down with Alan Lomax way after he was almost forgotten. He was playing in a down-and-out club in Washington, D.C. Nobody even knew who he was. He was barely getting paid to play. And Alan Lomax went in and sat down and recorded a number of conversations with him. And I've extracted excerpts of that conversation to highlight our show. Because what Jelly Roll does is he discusses the birth of what he says, the birth of jazz. Now, there's one thing you have to keep in mind when I play Jelly Roll's comments, just to start things off. The guy really was a typical American in a lot of ways. The first way is that he loved to tell a story. Second way is he didn't let the truth always get in the way of whether or not of how he told the story. So he's very American. Now, he's very good at self-aggrandizement. But the thing is, a lot of the things that he claims to have done and people ridiculed him for over the years and he had become forgotten for, now in retrospect, seems as if it wasn't really so much bragging as it was more true than not. I mean, there will be times in the course of our show where you hear him claiming to have invented jazz in the year 1902. It's an outrageous claim. But if you believe his birth date, where he said that he was born in 1885 as opposed to 1890, that would have made him 17 at that time. And that was very likely because he was, as a teenager, playing in the brothels of New Orleans at about that time. So I would like to suspend disbelief in the interest of this show. And I'd like to just, now that the man is gone, you also have to keep in mind also that when this show is recorded, like a lot of the point of this program, How Music Changed, is to show how things had developed. And even though things fell out of favor, they stay incredibly relevant. Keep in mind that these words by Jelly Roll Morton were recorded around 1938. And here it was, the man was totally out of fashion. Big band music, what was happening. Interestingly, the big bands were having huge hits, recording some songs that were written by Jelly Roll Morton. Songs like King Porter Stomp were being recorded.
Irony.
The irony is incredible. People like Benny Goodman had a huge hit with King Porter Stomp, but you know what? The song was never published by Jelly Roll Morton, so he never even got a penny for it. And he was considered to be old-fashioned, old school. He didn't change with the times, so he was more or less shunted aside. Here it is, approximately 100 years after the onset of Jelly Roll Morton's relevance, initial relevance, and now we see it for what it really is. So I'm gonna suspend my own talking for most of the program now, except for the occasional interruption between bits, and I'm gonna let Jelly Roll tell most of the stories, starting with his words about the Maple Leaf Rag, which we had just heard the original roll of by Scott Joplin. Take it away, Jelly Roll.
Seen such a snow in all my life. I just had left Johnny and Reb Spikes, the boys that wrote Someday Sweetheart. In fact, their name is on it. So, of course, they've got the full claim to it. We had left McCabe's Minstrel. I quit the show in St. Louis, and that's why I happened to be there.
There we have just the beginning of the story. It is so fabulous to hear Jelly Roll Morton's voice telling this story, and I only want to interrupt him at times in order to fill in some of the blanks for you. The fact is, Jelly Roll Morton certainly was among one of the very first human beings to ever play jazz, and right there, hearing what he had done to the Maple Leaf Rag is is ample evidence to show exactly that that would be true. One of the most interesting things that he tries to do, he was certainly the among the first, if not the very first person, almost certainly the first person to actually write down a jazz arrangement, where he would have ideas for what he wanted and he couldn't find players to do it because he really was ahead of his time. So he would literally write it down for other players to follow along with him and try to accompany him with the feel that he was looking for. Basically, the idea, I can read it from here in the book. From the very beginning, he seems to have wanted, both in his elegant piano playing and in the tunes he began composing, to produce music that incorporated both blues and ragtime, but was clearly different from either one. The blues were full of passion, but too simple, he said. Besides, most blues musicians were mere one-tune piano players. Ragtime piano players, on the other hand, were too prone to speeding things up, while the principle underlying the music that they played was just a certain kind of syncopation, and only certain tunes can be played in that idea. See, this is the genius of what Jelly Roll Morton had come up with. Jazz music, he says, is a style, not compositions. Any kind of music may be played in jazz.
He kind of referred to that in the first part that he said he jazzed a lot of different styles of music.
Exactly.
In his own words.
And that's what we just heard right there with Maple Leaf Rag. That's what you heard happening. Well, let's Jelly Roll tell some of his own story about his very earliest days growing up.
Tell you, as I can understand, my folks were in the city of New Orleans long before the Louisiana Purchase, and all my folks came directly from the shores, not the shores, I mean from France, that has crossed the world and the other world, and they landed here in a new world years ago. I remember so far back as my great-grandmother and great-grandfather.
Tell us about what their names were,
Jelly. Their names, my great-grandfather's name was Emile Peche. That's a French name. And the grandmother was Mimi Peche. It seems to be all French. And as long as I can remember those folks, they never was able to speak a word in American or English.
They own slaves?
Well, I don't know. I don't think they had no slaves back there in Louisiana. I don't think so. I don't know, but they never spoke of anything like that. But anyway, my grandmother, her name was Laura. She married a French settler in New Orleans by the name of Henry Monette. That was my grandfather. And either one of them spoke American or English. Well, my grandmother bore sons named Henry, Gus, Neville, and Nelisco, all French names. And she bore the daughters, Louise, and Viola, and Margaret. That was the three daughters. Louise, her elder daughter, happened to be my mother, Fred Jelly Roll Morton. Of course, I guess you wonder how the name Morton come in. By the name Morton being an English name, it wouldn't sound very much like a French name. But my real name is Ferdinand Lamont. My mother also married one of the French settlers in New Orleans out of a French family, being a contractor. My father was a brick contractor, bricklayer, making large buildings and so forth and so on. We always had some kind of a musical instruments in the house, including guitar, drums, piano, trombone, and so forth and so on, harmonica and jukebox. We had lots of them. And everybody always played for their pleasure, whatever the ones that desired to play. We always had ample time that was given us and periods to rehearse our lessons, which was given to anyone that was desirous in accepting lessons. But of course, the families, never had a night that they wanted musicians in the family to make their living. They always had it in their mind that a musician was a tramp. Other than the exceptions, with the exceptions of the French opera house players, which they always patronized. They only thought there was the great musicians in the country. In fact, I myself was inspired by going to the French opera house once, because the fact of it was I liked to play piano. And piano was known at that time to be an instrument for a lady. So I had, and in my mind, that if I played piano, I would be misunderstood.
Now I'll just interrupt Jelly Roll's story here just a little bit before we let him pick up again, so I can maybe offer a little clarity. The most interesting thing is when he talks about his heritage, you'll notice he totally denies any Creole heritage at all, when in fact he was Creole. He apparently just didn't want that to be known because of the fact that what was happening culturally and racially in the country. He felt that that was holding him back, apparently. And it's really sad, especially because just very soon after this recording was made, where he is recording these words, he went back to play in that Washington, D.C. dive bar. And he ended up getting knifed during a performance. And he nearly bled to death. They wouldn't let him into a white hospital that was the closest one to where he was. So he had to travel even further to get to a hospital they would allow people of color. And the time that was wasted during that time caused him to lose a tremendous amount of blood. They didn't do a single thing for him when he even got to that hospital for a very long time. They just put ice on his wounds. Oh. Turns out, a long story short, it wasn't that much longer afterward that maybe he did survive for maybe a couple of years, but those wounds eventually killed him before he ever reached the age of 50. And it's such a shame, because as we all know, eventually this type of music did experience a huge rebirth in the late 40s and 50s. Everybody was, early roots jazz was the biggest thing. And Jelly Roll Morton probably would have been a superstar all over again had he survived. So I just find that incredibly sad. Let's get back to Jelly Roll telling his story, though, about the early days of how he got his name and his time in New Orleans.
Numbers that's supposed to have had more originality to it than any other hot tune of blues in America, according to musicians, publishers, and so forth and so on, members of the music world. I didn't name the Jelly Roll Blues the Jelly Roll Blues. It was named by the people of the city of Chicago. How I happened to get the name myself thrown on me as an alias was due to the fact in the show business with one of my old partners, a blackface comedian and the first eccentric dancer in the United States, Sammy Russell, who was later known as Barlow, the teammate of Sandy Burns. One night while working at Lib on the stage doing comedy, Sam said to me, "You don't know who you're talking to." I told him I didn't care, and we had a little argument. I finally asked him who was he, and he stated to me he was Sweet Papa Cream Puff right out of the bakery shop. That seemed to produce a great big laugh. While I was standing there mugging, as you call it, a thought came to me that I better say something about the baker shop. I said to him he didn't know who he was talking to. He finally wanted to get acquainted, so he asked me who was I, and I stated to him I was Sweet Papa Jelly Roll with the stovepipes in my hips, and all the women in town was dying to turn my damper down.
What do you mean by saying you had stovepipes in your hips?
Well, stovepipes, I don't know. It was one of these kind of a things, you know, very warm, hot hips. So the people automatically named it. But my original title for this tune was the Chicago Blues. I'll now try to see if we can do a little bit of it.
Mm-hmm. minutes.
I just think it's a beautiful thing how Jelly Roll can sit there and talk all about the sexual innuendo about his name and everything and just do it so smooth.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. Let me just recount some of his earliest years just to catch you up with where we are. I mean, he was born in New Orleans. He was born in the Faubourg Marigny section, which is just
right
outside of the French
right
Quarter.
Behind the French Quarter.
Just behind it. And he grew up there, and he was totally in love with the music that was happening there all the time, and he kept sneaking into where he didn't belong, into the bad parts of town. And he, from a young age, when he did finally decide that he was going to play the piano, it wasn't long before he started seeking work in what they were calling the Tenderloin District, where, you know,
like Storyville.
Yeah, exactly. Where basically
the red light district,
red light whorehouses, all that stuff was going down, and he would basically want to play in that area. Now, what would happen is, this is crazy, but this is the way it would work back then. If you were looking for a woman, you would go in and you'd pay for a girl and a piano player. And the three of you would go into a room, because remember, this was really before recorded music was in existence. It was the piano player's job to set the mood. So while he sat at the piano with his back, the woman and the girl would drink and make love and do what they were doing.
The woman and the
John, so to speak, would get at it while the piano player more or less kept the mood going for him. And this is what Jelly Roll was doing. Now, keep in mind that he was also, his family hated the fact that this could have been possible. I mean, like, as you said earlier, they considered musicians to be low down, so he lied about what he was doing, saying he was working in a barrel factory at night. But one day he was coming home from working in one of these houses, and his grandmother, who he was living with at the time, happens to see him walking down the street wearing a Stetson hat and a fine suit, and
uh-oh,
she's like, "Where do you think you're coming from wearing those clothes this time of day, this, you know, this early in the morning? Where are you coming from?" And just in a moment of candor, he just said, well, told her the truth. She kicked him out of the house.
Oopsie.
So that was it. From that point on, he pretty much had to hit the road. So he had left New Orleans, and this is when he started doing the vaudeville circuit and visiting some of the places that he was talking about. And that's why how he mentioned he got the name Jelly Roll there during a vaudeville routine when he was teamed up with somebody just trying to walk around, traveling all over the South, getting work, sometimes going as far north as Chicago when he was doing this. That song that he was talking about, Jelly Roll Blues, happens to be the song that they were saying might have been the very first jazz composition ever published, or at least, you know, recorded as sheet music in the New Orleans tradition. And what's really interesting about that is that around this time, if you remember, we were talking about people like Buddy Bolden. Mm-hmm. Buddy Bolden never recorded, and he would always play with keeping a handkerchief over his hand. Jazz musicians or blues musicians, whatever you wanted to call it back then, ragtime musicians, whatever.
Right,
whatever.
He didn't want anyone to see his phrasing.
Incredibly secretive about how they did what they did. They didn't want people to see it, to know it, so they would hide it. So most people, that's why Buddy Bolden never even recorded. He would never let anybody try to study his music that way. Jelly Roll was the exact opposite. He was, I'm going to write it down. I'm doing this. I can. I'm going to put it on paper. He was the first one to actually do that. So it's fairly interesting. The other thing that I want to mention before he picks up his story is what was happening in New Orleans around. Actually, you know what? Let's play a track before we begin. How about this track? Here's one of the tracks that was published by Jelly Roll Morton. This is entitled Shreveport Stomp. Thank you. Now, if you listen to that at all, you should certainly be able to hear how the idea of ragtime was beginning to change and become something a little bit different in the hands of Jelly Roll Morton. It was definitely the onset of something completely new and different. Now, to set up his next story, I would also like to mention, if you were listening to our earlier shows, we spent a little bit of time discussing what was happening in New Orleans around the turn of the century. And it's very important to remember that in New Orleans at that time, there was a real bouillabaisse of humanity, all different types of people from all different races, colors, creeds, and they were getting along pretty well. In fact, they were intermingling really well. It was a whole different stratum of society that was going on in New Orleans, where they had things broken down into quarters, eighths, halves. Oh my! How people were mixed and what was going on with different blends of people. It was just something to.
Everybody had their own society and they were
all intermingling and they had different different stratums and right. There were the Creoles and there were whites and there were blacks and there were all different types of combinations of each. There was also the blues players and the ragtime players and the opera houses, and now this onset of what was beginning to come from all of these things mixing together, which was jazz. Something happened that made this a little bit very different, very difficult for it to continue the way that it did. And Jelly Roll Morton tells that story right now in a situation of like a riot that took place once because of some murders by a man named Robert Charles. He tells the story a little bit roundabout, but I think you'll be able to follow it if you pay attention. I'll let Jelly Roll Morton tell you the story.
Well, after that, why, he shot the policeman, as I stated, see, and killed him. And seemingly that Robert Charles must have been a marksman. It was later learned that Robert Charles made all of his own bullets and had a couple of barrels of them. And every time he would raise his rifle, when a policeman was in sight, there'd be a policeman dead. It was never learned how many policemen were killed. Some said 32, some said 18, and so forth and so on. They had different numbers that were stated in the police department or the papers. Robert Charles was very orderly, seeming to everybody, never had any trouble before. But this arose him to fury, and through this killing, it started a great New Orleans riot. People, innocent people of all kind, were killed. Robert Charles lived in a little bit of small shack-like. There was another one right next to his, I would say, twin houses. It was stated from time to time that this building was burned down in order to get Robert Charles out. But I can assure you, I was there when it all happened, and I was there when it all stopped. There was no burning, but I think it was smoked in order to get this gentleman out. After the riot, there has never been anything of authenticity where Robert Charles had been captured. It was learned later years that he'd gotten sick or something happened to him, and he was supposed to have confessed that he was the Robert Charles. He also had a friend with him at that time that wanted to betray him. I think this man was killed. In fact, I'm sure that he was. And that was the end of Robert Charles. They had a song out on Robert Charles. Like many other songs and like many other bad men that always had some kind of a song and somebody originated on them. But this song was squashed very easily by the department, and not only by the department, by any of the surrounding people that ever heard the song, due to the fact that it was a trouble breeder, and it never did get very far. I used to know the song, but I found it was best for me to forget it, and that I did, in order to go along with the world on the peaceful side.
You can't remember any of it, not the word or one line,
Well, I don't remember the music at all.
How'd the words go?
Well, there's a few words that stated Robert Charles was a paper man that sold papers at a market. That wouldn't be the words exactly, and that he had some trouble with his wife, and a policeman wouldn't get him, let him get his hat. And on this, he broke away from the officer and shot this gentleman. And that started a riot, because, of course, if you shoot one officer, it's the more than right that another officer should come to take his place.
I'm only interrupting here because I'd like to point out that you need to remember that these voice recordings of Julie Roe Morton that were made by Alan Lomax, he made them on a very old, naturally, in 1938, the technology was limited, and they were recorded on aluminum acetate discs, and every now and then they would just run out, so they'd have to stop, change the disc, put another one on, and then pick up the conversation again, which is exactly what is happening here. Also, when this happens, sometimes the quality of the audio changes a little bit, so I'll just beg your patience when you listen to this, and maybe sometimes you might have to pay a little bit more close attention than in other places. Well, here I'll let Julie Roe Morton continue the story.
So the song was quelled, as I first stated. And of course, I'm a little bit ahead of my time before the song came out. After the killing, that first day, which I believe was on Sunday, the next day, the riots broke out after the newspapers were filled with the killing of the policemen. This man also killed a policeman that was gazing at another brother officer that was dying when a priest was making his rites and looking over the priest's shoulders. And he raised his rifle and shot the officer, supposedly right between the eyes, and didn't harm the priest. Men were beat up on streetcars, white and colored. Any place you've seen a white man seen a colored man, there was a fight. Or a colored man seen a white man, there was a fight. All for the trouble of Robert Charles. The streetcars had to stop. Transportation had absolutely quit. Abe Baldwin was a big prominent factor in New Orleans at the time. Abe Baldwin, I believe, is a great ammunition dealer, considered one of the biggest in the world. He also supposed to be connected, as I understand, with the big locomotive companies. And he issued a statement, if they didn't quit killing the colored people, that he would all arm them. He'd arm all of them in order to let them fight back for their rights. And through this, I believe, came a halt of the Robert Charles riot.
I believe so.
I believe so. And, of course, vice versa. Of course, I can't see any reason for these things anyway. Arguments with you and I don't see why anybody else should harm you or harm me for it. At that time, we had a lot of great blue players around. For instance, we had one of the famous ones at that time, nothing but blues, named Game Kid. Game Kid was one of the favorites in the Garden District, right in the section where the Robert Charles riot began. Here's one of the blues he played. Right here, take a thousand miles away.
have a little bit more of Jelly Roll Morton telling a story as eloquently as can be and then launching into a tune, the ultimate showman that he is.
Yes, he is.
You know, like I said, keep in mind that this is recorded in 1938 at a time when he was pretty much thoroughly forgotten. Even by historians, he was forgotten. And yet, listen to the quality of his playing. He never lost an ounce of his ability. He just sounds great. And if he was this good, or you know, but younger.
Well, I think that's probably a little bit of a testament to his French heritage. You know, the whole Fay Dodo thing too.
How do you mean?
Well, people would get together and tell stories. That's what they.
Right.
That's what a Fay Dodo is.
That's exactly what I think is going on there with what he's doing. As he accompanies himself to be sure that he keeps himself paced. It's brilliant. Let's hear one more track that Jelly Roll Morton recorded. This is another one of his early songs. I'd say another one of his ragtime-influenced jazz tunes. This one entitled Wolverine Blues. Wonderful Wolverine Blues. Well, it's just called the Wolverine Blues, but I added wonderful. I believe the accompaniment there, it's a trio, and I'm pretty sure that his accompaniment is Baby Dodds and Johnny Dodds, the New Orleans brothers, who played drums and clarinet. They did a lot of work with Louis Armstrong as well in the early days. And those are two people who were very sympathetic to what Jelly Roll was about and got it just automatically, intrinsically. It was in their blood, too. Now, for the next part of the story that I'm going to let Jelly Roll tell you, if you recall when we did our show on the birth of jazz, we just spent a lot of time discussing Buddy Bolden. We were unable to play any of his music, as I had said earlier, that happened simply because Buddy Bolden refused to let himself be recorded. So he is not the he could have been the first recorded artist, you know, the first jazz artist to have been recorded, but he elected to not let that be the case. But we know a little bit about him. Luckily, we know what we do know, really, because of people like Jelly Roll Morton, who at least took the time to sit down and talk about him a little bit, gave us a huge amount of insight that might have otherwise been completely forgotten to history. So I'll let Jelly Roll talk a little bit here about the great Buddy Bolden. There we have another time to change the aluminum acetate disc.
Oh, darn, I was trying to figure out where he was for that Linkin Park. Oh,
we'll pick it right back up. I'm loving this, though, because I don't know if our listeners know this. It's just worth mentioning that Heidi was born and raised in New Orleans, so all these locations that he's talking about, I see Heidi's nodding and recognizing every one of these geographic spots. So it's very interesting
for me.
It's
funny because my dad's also a Mason, so I know that exact Mason's Lodge. It's not – you can just see the Mason symbol on the outside of the building where it used to be. Yeah, it's no longer even a building that's used anymore by anybody.
That's fabulous to know. That's very interesting. Well, let's continue with the story with Jelly Roll Morton talking about Buddy Bolden.
Yes, any time it was a quiet night out in Lincoln Park, which I before stated, it was at least about 10 or 12 miles from the corner that we hung out. Maybe an affair wasn't so well publicized, so in order to get it publicized in a few seconds, Buddy would just take his big trumpet and just turn it around towards the city and blow this very tune that I'm talking about. In other words, the tune is, I thought I heard Buddy Bolden say, and the whole town would know that Buddy was there. And in a few seconds, why, the parks would start to get filled. It was nothing for Buddy to fill any place that you could hear his horn during those times. Oh, I heard him up until he went to the crazy house. And later he went to the crazy house, but I had an opportunity to be in the Jackson Hall once when he was playing at some matinee, a holiday. And there was a man standing at the stationary bar, a little bit of short fellow, seemingly he was sick, had rheumatism. And a great big husky guy steps on his foot, and I was just between them. And they got in an argument, and a little bit of guy didn't want to stand for it and just pulled out a great big gun almost as long as he was old and shot, and if I hadn't pulled my stomach back, he'd have shot me in the stomach. He killed this guy, laying on the floor, and my goodness, Buddy Bolden started blazing away. He was up on the balcony bandstand and started a blazing away for all it was worth in order to try to keep the crowd together. I realized it was a killing, and many others did too, and we start breaking out windows, just going all through the doors. They always had a policeman, one policeman, all at all dances, two sometimes, run over the policemen and everything. After I got on the outside, I felt that I was safe, so I decided that I'd look and see what would happen. After a while, the patrol pulled up. They took the dead man and they laid him in the bottom of the patrol wagon. And they finally, here comes the little man that shot him, little crippled man that is full of rheumatism. And later on, they put Buddy Bolden in the patrol. And I've often wondered, why would they put Mr. Bolden in that patrol? And he was up there trying to blow the notes to keep everything quiet. And I was right there and seen the man got killed.
Why did Buddy Bolden go crazy?
Why, I tell you, they claim that Buddy Bolden went crazy because he really blew his brains through the trumpet. He's the blowingest man that ever lived since Gable. He was really a great man at that, but he didn't play jazz. He was a ragtime player.
Where'd he come from?
Buddy Bolden was a New Orleans boy, as far as I know.
A Negro?
He was a Negro, yes. Right in New Orleans.
Dark or?
No, he was light-complected. He was what you call a light brown-skinned boy.
Did he drink hard?
Drank all the whiskey he could find or anybody else could find. And a funny thing about those guys in those days, a musician didn't think he was a good musician if he had a collar and tie on. He wouldn't wear a collar and tie. He'd have his shirt busted wide open, every button open, and have a red flannel undershirt so the girls could see it. And that was a great fad. The girls went and how did they go for those red undershirts?
Times change, boy. I don't think red undershirts are going to quite cut it these days anymore.
I don't know. You might try one.
Good point. I tell you, the other thing that's really fascinating about hearing this is people think that you go down to New Orleans in the past, you know, lately, these days, and you go to Bourbon Street, and boy, is it crazy. But listen to these stories. 8-10 dead on a Saturday night ain't no big thing, and the riots that were taking place at various times. Yep. It's absolutely incredible. And in a city full of characters. And it obviously, as you can tell, it's a city that has always been full of characters. There's no doubt that Jelly Roll Morton was among one of the biggest characters of the entire city. Also, it might have been a little bit interesting to note that the way that he refers to Buddy Bolden as not being a jazz player, it might have been a bit of premeditated on Jelly Roll Morton's part to say that. If he wants to say that he's the person who invented jazz, it wouldn't be appropriate to say that Buddy Bolden was playing jazz.
Right.
So he'd have to refer to him as either a blues player or a ragtime player
right.
in order to take the credit himself, which is probably what that was about when he said that there. And also, to be true, you know, to be true about it, I mean, if you think about all these people that are existing in the exact same place at the same time and they're all co-opting ideas from each other, it's really hard to really, to honestly say that it was one specific person. But even if Jelly Roll has given himself a tremendous amount of credit, I believe that, I personally believe that 90 to 95% of what the man is saying actually does prove itself to be true, more or less. You know, just read between the lines on the finer points. We're going to have to continue with this story next week as we continue with our series of How Music Changed. I want to point out that if you enjoy the show, you can catch this on the web at AmericanHitNetwork.com. That's our website, or you can hear it again. If you want to hear this and previous shows, which I would highly recommend if you're interested in this type of thing, you can catch early episodes of How Music Changed at ShutUpAndListen.com. That's ShutUpAndListen.com. Meanwhile, we'll be back next Friday with another part B of our Jelly Roll Morton series for How Music Changed. And to close it out, let's play that track as recorded by Jelly Roll Morton. Here is I Thought I Heard Buddy Bolden Say. See you next Friday, folks.
Buddy Bolden say, you nasty but you dirty, take it away, you're terrible, you're awful, take it away, I thought I heard him say, I thought I heard Buddy Bolden shout, open up that window and let that bad air out. Open up that window and let that foul air out. Yes, I thought I heard Buddy Bolden.